Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. This edition of the podcast is slightly different as it was hosted in front of a live audience at the Sand Valley Golf Resort in Wisconsin. Bill Coore and Jim Craig of renowned Coore and Crenshaw Design joined the podcast to discuss their brand new 17-hole par 3 course, the Sandbox, and their 18-hole Sand Valley design, as well as other topics. The podcast starts with an introduction from Sand Valley General Manager Glenn Murray. Without any further delay, here's Bill Coore and Jim Craig.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie. I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
I've got the distinct honor to introduce tonight's panel. I'll start with the team of Coore Crenshaw, who are an acclaimed design firm in the world of golf, spanning over the last 35 years. Their record really goes without saying. I could rattle off a lot of very renowned courses like the Sand Hills or Bandon Trails or Stream Song Red or Old Sandwich or Cabot Cliffs, and I'm not even doing that list justice. The thing that really strikes me the most about your firm is the work ethic. I've been in the golf industry for the last 20 years, and you work with a lot of different partners, and your firm works as hard as anyone that I've seen in the industry in my 20-year career. The other thing that has always been a common theme with working with anybody from Coore Crenshaw is just how they, treat everybody they treat everybody like ladies and gentlemen. Like from my Ritz-Carlton background, I certainly had that burned into my training, but you guys really have that throughout your firm. So the Sandbox opened today, and Ben Crenshaw had another commitment. But as we joke about the Sandbox, we often call it, the short name for Coore Crenshaw has been CNC. And, they often refer to it's a CNC design, but we've kind of internally called it a CCNC design because Jim Craig has really been the champion behind bringing this course to life. And if you had any fun on it today, I'd like to hear a little round of applause for that course. So while Coore Crenshaw has been around for 35 years, there's a new brand in golf that's been growing over the last 2-3 years called the Fried Egg. So they've amassed quite a following in terms of social media and blogs and their followers. So I get to introduce our moderator tonight. I give him a lot of credit for following a dream. He had a successful career in tech, but knew that golf was his real passion. And so he kind of jumped 2 feet in to becoming a golf writer, a golf blogger. He writes on all things about golf and travel, but he really focuses in on golf course architecture, which is what we're here to talk about tonight. So I'd like to introduce the founder of the Fried Egg, Andy Johnson.
All right. Thanks, everybody, and what an honor to be here with these two gentlemen that have done some incredible work across the world. Playing the Sandbox, you get the feeling. I grew up playing at a Muni course, but I also played a par 3 course down the street. And it makes me think, when I play there, wow, if I had gotten to play the Sandbox on a regular basis, how much more golf I would have played as a kid. And I played a lot of golf. So It's really a great course. I think from just hearing people walking around the first tee, walking around the resort, the biggest question out there is, why 17 holes?
Well, I am going to immediately defer to Jim and Michael and Chris Kaiser, who are back there in the back, because they are the ones who came up with this idea, because we were finishing the Sand Valley course, and the next thing I know, I get a call from Jim, and he says, you know, Bill, would you and Ben, you know, what do you think about a short course here? I said, well, if they think there's a market for it, absolutely. But I know particularly, Jim, I'm going to let you finally answer this, but I know particularly you and Michael had discussions about the attractiveness or potential attractiveness of that. And Ben and I just tagged along, man. We just said, we think it's a great idea. Let's see what we can do. So, Jim, you can explain how this idea actually originated.
No, you have your own. Sorry.
We're fancy.
Yeah.
So you're good to go.
Is it live? Okay. Yeah. Well, thanks for being here tonight. It's nice to see all your faces and know that you actually got to play out there. Thanks to Glenn and his staff for everybody. They do a great job here at Sand Valley, and I'm glad you guys all came. I think we should give a nice hand to those guys. I have no idea how we ended up with 17 holes. It was started to be a par two course. I didn't have no idea what a par two course is. I've never seen one. We had 20 holes that you could putt to. We called it, we had 20 twos. And that didn't work. So, Michael, more or less? Well, less. 18? No, that's too conventional. Well, let's go see how many good ones we can find. And we found 17 good ones. Thanks to him. Yeah, I think it's a good call. We enjoyed this opportunity to find that many holes, first of all. It's great material out here. It's a wonderful opportunity.
Well, it's interesting too. I guess the foundation of that whole concept started with Mike Kaiser, who I remember when he had the idea that we would do the short course, the preserve at Bandon Dunes. And there was this triangle of land that overlooked the ocean in the dunes that Ben and Mike and I all wanted to put into Bandon Trails. And we realized if we did it, the dunes were very closely configured in terms of contours. And if we tried to build regulation length holes there, we were going to have to bulldoze them away to make them work. We thought that site was just simply too pretty to do that. So we skipped it. And it was a bit painful to skip that and not use it. And then when Mike came back a few years later and said, Bill, Ben, I think we need a par three course here for people who are coming to play. And just, you know, there comes a point they can't just walk and play 36 holes a day. He said, I think we need a par three course, and I think we all know where it should be. He remembered that particular piece of ground where the preserve is. But I guess what I'm getting to, Jim, is I remember distinctly the day, Michael, Chris, that I was with your dad. And I said, Mike, so you want to build a par three course. How many holes do you want it to be? And he said, I don't care as long as it's not 9 or 18. Any other number is fine. Just find the best holes you can find and do that and build the holes. He said, I don't care if they're 60 yards long or 160 yards long, but build holes that are good enough that you could take any one of them off the par three course and put it on one of the regulation courses, and it would be very well accepted. So that's when you look back to Sand Valley, to me personally, that's where I trace it back to that idea. And then Michael, Chris, you and Jim took that and ran with it here and produced what you played today.
So thanks to the success of the preserve and now and many other short courses around the country, it's become really a big trend. And I think the demand for short courses is up. When you guys go about designing a short course, how does it differ from that of a regular course?
Well, I think, Andy, for me, it's you get an opportunity to do some things that you probably would not be able to do on a regulation length course. For those of you who played today, a prime example of that is the third green, which is what we refer to as the double plateau green. To those who might not know that concept, it's the green out there. It looks like it's got two matchboxes buried in it with a trough in between. And that's a very famous green at the National Golf Links in Long Island. And it works there on the 11th hole. But generally, it's hard to make something that extreme work in a regulation golf course. And we just felt like that we could do those kind of things on a short course. And Jim, again, leading this whole thing with the Kaiser family, said, let's come up with some of the neatest stuff that we've never been able to do. So it gives us an opportunity from a design standpoint to do that. It also gives the opportunity from a playing standpoint to play golf in quick fashion and not spend half a day or the entire day doing it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, actually, when we were deciding on some holes out there, I think you and some extra gentlemen over there talked about what we should do for a trophy for the event out there. And it's kind of like the same thing. We, you know, had some ideas kicking around with a bunch of folks, and you know, I think that's the way we did here. We talked to the folks around that were all in for a par three course and thought, well, now what would you like to do if you had your pick here? I'm surprised that we only kept with 17 holes, because if somebody had to say stop, because I'd probably still be out there building holes. But it was a collaborative effort, no doubt.
And I guess, Andy, too, from the standpoint, if you're in our business, and particularly if you're one of the younger guys working in this business, so much of that time is spent just trying to fulfill someone else's concept or someone else's the principal for whom you work or something. Not so much for Jim, who's worked with us since he was 5 years old, but there's a young guy working out here named Ryan Farrell, who has an extraordinary background in golf architecture and education and implementation. But as we would go through out there, I remember walking through, and it's the 12th hole right there. We had walked past it numerous times. No one had ever done a sketch. No one had ever done a concept for it. We just kept walking by it. And finally, we walked by there one day, and Jim and Ryan and I are walking by, and Jim goes, well, what are we going to do here? I had no idea. I had never even thought about it. And I just says, well, what we're going to do here is walk to the next hole, and Ryan's going to figure out what this is going to be. So we kid about it being the Farrell hole. But, you know, that's interesting for people who are involved in this business of building stuff to be able to go, I've had an idea. I would like to try to implement it. And then to implement it and see folks like you come and say, that's pretty neat. I enjoyed that. So it's part of the really positive aspects of this whole business.
Jim, have you ever had an idea that you were really nervous to show Bill, that, you know, whether it was on the Sandbox or Sand Valley or any other course, that, you know, you had this idea that he was just talking about with, you know, Ryan's idea of the hole?
Yeah. I have. I have. It's a pretty regular thing. I have to kind of ask permission to do much of anything. Five? I wasn't really five. I was actually like 25. But I acted five. So there's a lot of that. I could make you a list of things, you know, but the patience that this man has shown me. Whew. You know him.
How does your day-to-day work, Jim? How does building a green, you know, the manner in which you do it, how does the process work?
Well, I think it's different, you know, everywhere we go. We obviously have good direction. You know, Hogan used to say, you know, that the swing was 9/10 over its setup. And, you know, the way we've been lucky, you know, to have sites that were, you know, very conducive for golf, and And William and Ben have always found a way to, you know, get around that property with as, you know, as gracefully as possible. So it, depending on what the material's like, it's if we could say it's all the same, we talk about concepts and the way it would match with what's behind it or what's in front of it. And we rough something in, working at the green, working at all the green sites, and kind of a place to start that may move a little bit here or there, but start at the green and then work backwards, I think, is what we do. Sometimes it moves, sometimes it evolves, but it's fun.
Shane and Michael had a great conversation last night, and Michael really talked about how you guys like to use and highlight the land. What were the core aspects of both Sand Valley and the Sandbox that you wanted to highlight about the natural features of the land here at Sand Valley?
Oh, I think, Andy, it was, you know, anytime you're given the opportunity to work with a truly gifted piece of property, a property that seems like it can yield a very interesting golf course without a lot of alteration, you want to work with it, not against it. So we come with the philosophy, as Jim said, that we come with no preconceived notions as to what the length of the course is going to be, what the style of the course is going to be, what the whatever is going to be. We try to study the property and say, we're going to let this guide us in terms of what the course will turn out to be. So with Sand Valley, I remember out here, Ben and I'd be walking with Jim, and, you know, when they cleared the trees off of it, it took on a very similar appearance because it's ridges and valleys. And, of course, it's all sand, so it's aptly named in that regard. But I remember the first time we walked through and talking to Jim, and we're gonna have to figure out how to make these holes where they don't all look alike. Because when you started looking at the landforms and the big scale of the landforms, it would have been easy to become very, very repetitive out there. Run all the holes down the valleys, for example. Run them all perpendicular over the hills or whatever the case may be. And so we tried to study and say, all right, if we were out here walking around, how would we walk around this property without being too physically taxing? And how would we then lay holes out that would be different and still interesting, but complement this site? So in that case, that's what we did with Sand Valley. In the case of the Sandbox, it was almost the complete opposite. When Jim said that he and Michael and Chris and had been thinking about, you know, the possibility of doing a par three course, went out there and looked. It's much smaller. It's much smaller scale. It's much flatter. And we thought, this is perfect because Sand Valley, the golf course Sand Valley is a big scale. The golf course Mammoth Dunes is absolutely perfectly named because it's mammoth in scale. And so we thought the par three course, the fact that they had chosen this site that was down here, much smaller scale, much more intimate, much more level, would give the opportunity to do a golf product that was completely different than the other courses. So, in a sense, both of them, the big scale of Sand Valley, the smaller, more intimate scale at the Sandbox, was driven by the sites who were built on.
You've done a lot of work with the Kaisers, and obviously since 1999, when Bandon Dunes started, the golf industry started to have a seismic shift. Obviously, Sand Hills was a big part of that in 95. What about working with the Kaisers is different than, say, other clients?
Oh, this is hard to say with these guys sitting in the room, but
it's my job. Got to ask the hard questions.
Yeah, I know, Andy. You did. This family has done so much, been so positive for golf, not just in America, but in the world. They are changing the way people perceive golf. People for so many years perceived that the very best golf courses in the world were exclusive. They were private. They were hard to get access to. And their whole concept is exactly the opposite. Let's find sites that are site-driven, not demographically driven. They're driven by the contours of the ground to produce the most interesting courses, not the population that happens to be or not be adjacent to it. And so they took that concept and then said, and we want it to be public access. Mike Kaiser was a founding member of the course we did at the Sandhills. And that in and of itself is special. But the fact, you know, he looked and said, I wish everybody could see the Sandhills. I wish it could happen. But then to say, now, my family and I are going to go try to present opportunities for people to experience that type of golf, but do it in a public access arena is truly special. And, you know, in our business, Andy, the greatest thing you could ever hope for is to be given a truly special site and the freedom to work with it, not work for an owner who lords over you and says, I want this, I want that, it's going to be this, I don't like that, that type thing. And Mike and now Michael and Chris and the family, they don't do that. They give you the opportunity to work with something extraordinary and the freedom to work with it. And are they involved? Absolutely. And that's for the betterment of each project. But I think history will record that this family will be hugely impactful in the evolution of golf in a most positive way. And, Michael, Chris, I've said to your dad numerous times, Mike, you've given us so many opportunities. Maybe it's time for somebody else to get to experience this. And Michael's and Chris's dad's the same age I am. So we kind of look at each other. And he does. They do. They're giving opportunities for younger architects and different people to be experiencing. But at the same time, once in a while, Mike looks at me and goes, Bill, I'm getting old. I'm kind of getting set in my ways. And I go, there's a part of me feels guilty about that, and there's another part that just goes, thank you, Lord. We're just going to follow these people wherever they want to go, as long as they want us.
I imagine, like, we talked about this when we talked earlier about when Dick Youngsap called you about Sandhills, like, you want to build in Nebraska? When they said, hey, we got a great site in central Wisconsin, what was your immediate reaction?
Well, my immediate reaction to Mike on the phone was, Mike, the last time I looked, I didn't see an ocean next to Wisconsin. Now, maybe at one time, many millennia ago, there was, but I just don't see it there because Mike had told me through the years, he said, I'm only going to go where I can find sand next to the ocean, dunes next to the ocean. That was the cornerstone and the thing that he looked for most. And so coming here was a bit of a, not just a leap, but it was off on a different tangent. And Craig Haltom, who's out here, who came and discovered this property through research through over the entire state of Wisconsin to find a sand site, and then was able to meet one person in particular, Australian guy whom we both know, but who said this could be neat, and introduced him to Mike. And I remember Mike telling me, he said, Bill, I'm going to go look at a site up in Wisconsin. Where's the ocean? And he came here and he called afterward and he goes, well, I went there with every intention of saying no. And he said, I walked around the site and walked with Craig Haltom. And, Chris, Michael, I don't know exactly who all was here at that point, but some of the Kemper Sports people. And Mike, at least the way he conveyed it to me, was I went there to say no, and I came away ready to say yes.
Getting back to short courses and the sandbox, what is it, do you think, about these courses that are making them so popular in today's game?
Well, I mean, my personal perspective is it's, and I grew up playing on some par three courses in North Carolina many years ago. The problem was at that point in time, Andy, that a par three course was more often than not considered to be a second choice, a second rate citizen, a second something, something that was you did if you couldn't get to a primary course. And what's happening now is that that concept's been flipped and turned on its head, so to speak. And with things like the preserve, like the sandbox, like the cradle that Gil Hance and the people at Pinehurst have done, like what Tom Doak has done, like all these things that are now coming online, par three courses that are ever as interesting as regulation scale golf, is exposing people, in this case, most of us in the room played a lot of golf. It exposes us to interesting golf on a small scale, but probably more importantly, it gives people in this room and people like Jim and, you know, with younger families, the chance to expose them to really interesting golf, and in such a way that it doesn't become so frustrating. They can play it faster. It plays into this whole idea. How do you get people involved? How do you do it in without taking up an entire day doing it? But the ability to do that and then do it in a reasonable amount of time with today's, well, particularly with young folk who have opportunities to be exposed to so many things, the attention span for natural reasons is much tighter. So and shorter, and so this gives people a chance. That this is real golf. It's on a small scale. This is the real thing, and you know, it's just neat for us to see. And as we said, it's a chance for us to do something on a smaller scale that we might not be able to do on a bigger. And Jim, I don't know how you would expand on that.
I think that's exactly right. You know, the frustration can sometimes be caused by just maybe having your youngster with you on a course that might hold up play or something. You know, you kind of feel a little bit like, oh, we got to scoot along here, unless it's late in the day. I grew up, you know, if I could reach the gas pedal, I was hustling carts for candy bars or something so I could get out and play when everybody was gone. But this... If we all hit tee balls off of a hole, one of us may be over there and one of us may be over there. And on these short, you know, playing at the green from all different spots, which is great. It's fun. But these shorter ideas, they seem like, you know, you can have a collection of holes that you could all walk out there to the, you know, short of the green and all drop a ball and say, let's go from right here. And it gives you a nice way to learn the game, whether it's with your kid or your grandma or you know, just anybody. And they, if it's grandma, she might just beat you, you know, and that's pretty neat.
I can think of when the preserve opened and I was standing on the first tee with Mike Kaiser, and there was one group there, Andy, that played, had four generations of players, went from an 80-some-year-old man to an 8-year-old. And each generation, you know, in between, it may have been actually five now I'm thinking about it, but it was a fascinating thing to see. That's something you wouldn't see on a regulation like big course. And it's just a neat aspect of what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's the coolest part of the par three courses and the short courses is it levels the field. You know, you could, you know, the 80-year-old could win or the 8-year-old could win, and everybody's on the same level. What did you guys learn from doing the preserve that you might have changed or, you know, made better doing the sandbox?
Well, on the one hand, they're completely different because the terrain's different. The thing they have in common is that sand base. But the biggest thing of all is I'm not sure any of us knew how well received the preserve would become. And so it was on a bit steeper terrain. So when we were doing the tees, the tee surfaces there are somewhat smaller than here. And through the years, we found that, quite frankly, they're too small. and been trying to expand some and this, that, and the other. So when we were about to embark on this, one of the first things, Jim and Michael and Chris went out and walked the preserve, talked to the superintendent out there about what the issues were, and it was absolutely, we need more tee space. So you'll see tees here, although they may not look big any individual level you're on, when you start looking, they spread out and they meander here and there and all around, and not only provide different angles, but more usable space.
Jim, were there any unique stories or challenges that you encountered during the construction phase?
You know, just seeing my face every day is a struggle for everybody. You know, it's like, oh, Lord, here he comes. How long is he going to stay today? You know, I think taking everybody's ideas that we were presented with and making them happen was it's easy to talk about stuff, you know, but actually making it happen is another thing. So it's a hard, you know, it's a heavy load to have a great idea and start in there at it, you know. It's a tough one. So I think everybody gave it their all. I mean, it's a pretty darn neat deal, and I think it's only going to get better out there when the surface gets a little like this. I think for the game, it's a good thing to take your eyes out of the air and put them on the ground, and you start to make sense of what's out there. So, yeah.
Yeah, I went around and was hitting just a 6-iron this afternoon. Yeah. It was a lot of fun. You could start to get imagination back, and it's funny, I was recently watching like a 1940 PGA championship, and that was the only shot these guys were hitting were along the ground. And it's so weird, you know, a guy's 100 yards out and he's just like running a ball up to the green. It's something you don't see today that is all of a sudden acceptable, and it's there, you just, nobody uses it.
You know, it's like somebody asked Michael about golf carts last night, and I loved it. He said, "Well, how much do golf carts cost? How much do you pay for rent?" And he didn't know the answer. I thought that was great. Like, you know, the thing that wasn't really in there was the opportunities that also offers with turf. You know, you can't hardly have a golf cart on fescue unless you have a cart path. And when you can grow fescue, that creates a whole nother game. The ground game is a game that, you know, if the course were solid bent grass, it would certainly limit you, you know, as to how that ball's going to react. And I think that's a great, you know, tribute to their belief in the game. And it gives us a chance to hit those shots that we see in Scotland, you know, that are super fun. And all that ground you can play over is just a different game. It really neat. So.
We open it up for questions from the crowd. Who's got them? So the question is, how much of your design is done on the computer versus the field? And then once you get out on the ground, how much does it change?
Well, if you're asking me, I'm
he has no email address.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think he could turn one on. Yeah. Look, yeah. His wife counts the steps. He can't even charge this thing.
Yeah, yeah.
He does use emojis, though. Yeah.
He does. Yeah. He does.
Yeah. No, Ben and I, Jim not so much, but Ben and I are lumbering dinosaurs waiting for extinction who do not either use a computer nor have an email address or anything like that. So I've never used a computer in my life. I wouldn't know what to do with it other than just open it and look at it and wonder what to do next. So we're still very much the old-fashioned way. And I'm not saying this is right. You know, if I were Jim's age or Andy's age or something and really trying to get established in the golf design profession, obviously I couldn't do it. But given the background and things, can still go out there and just wander around with topographical maps and make notes on it but mentally just visualizing and getting a sense of the property and how do you walk across it, and if this, does it have any attributes for golf or not, and if it does, how would you start to visualize a golf course being laid out on this. I mean, in our case, it's generally trying to figure out a circulation pattern. How would you go out there and walk around the property? People do it with computers all the time. The vast majority of people do. We're still the old way of, well, let's go out there. Let's take 2 or 3 days or 4 or 5 days, and let's walk around. And if I were coming out here not even thinking about golf, how would I want to walk around this property to see the most interesting elements and do it in such a way I don't feel like it's so physically demanding? I mean, yeah, I still to this day believe that's a good way to go. And once you can get a kind of a sense of the property and a sense of how you would travel around it, then you start to try to figure out how to break that into terms of golf and golf holes. But I guess specifically to your question, we use the computer zero. And the rest of it is, you know, depending on what degree.
So when Bill has an idea for a hole, how does he present it to you? Does he just, you know, does he just say, hey, you know, this is what I'm thinking, and you go do it?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Yeah. You know, I think every site challenges us a little bit to come up with something on our own. And like Ryan's hole out here, you know, we kept walking past it, and finally we said, Ryan, do something, and he did. So, there's all kinds of ways, but he has so much direction. His mind is like a computer. You know, he makes it sound like it's just, just a little pleasant. He's like that Ross guy that used to do the paintings. And here's your happy little tree over here and paint your. But there's not a minute or a place that he doesn't think about. And I think one of the greatest things to see is I don't know that I've ever actually done what he's asked me to do. He gets there and goes, oh, geez. How are we going to make chicken salad out of this? And somehow he does. He finds good in just about everything that we do. And it may not be exactly what he was thinking, but we're able to do something different, and we keep changing every day. We don't ever do it the same way. I can guarantee you that. Saving grace for me is I forget most things. So forgiving things is really easy for me. So he's a fun man to follow, I can tell you that.
Well, I will say this. I won't get off too much on a tangent here, I hope. But Ben and I for years have said, we are so fortunate. I mean, Jim is sitting here tonight. There are other people who've worked with us for years who are equally talented and extraordinary people. And one of the great misconceptions in golf architecture is that there's some one person who walks out on this site, has every idea, every concept preconceived or figured out, and gives it to someone to go build. That just simply does not happen. And if it does, the golf course is not going to be very good. We have through all these years tried to work with extraordinarily talented people and give them the freedom to work too. Just like the Kaisers give us the freedom to work, we try to give Jim and the other guys the freedom to work, because you know how talented they are. Why on earth, if you were a jockey, would you get on a horse, try to win a race, and be there telling the horse, pick up your right hoof, put down your left, pick up, you know. You don't do that. You say, we're going in this direction. This is the goal. This is what we're trying to do. You run for it. Go for it. And so many times we end up being, yes, we have ideas, but so many times we end up being editors as well, Andy, observing the work that talented people do and then saying, this fits within the concept, let's go with this. Mm-hmm.
It's like one of my friends as a writer said that, you know, all writing sucks until it gets edited. So the question is, mentioned National Golf Links. What are 5 or 6 other courses that you and Ben have been inspired by?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, probably we would pick many of the ones the folks here tonight would pick. But Ben and I both grew up playing on Well, I grew up playing as a kid some around a lot of Donald Ross courses, but then when I was in school at Wake Forest, there was a Perry Maxwell golf course literally adjacent to the campus, and that course influenced me so much. Ben, in when he was a kid, grew up playing on the original Austin Country Club, which was a Perry Maxwell course. So we had that in common. As to Perry Maxwell did some of the most incredibly artistic greens ever. He worked with Alistair McKenzie on a number of projects and things. But so we had that in common, Perry Maxwell courses. But, you know, we would just go see things. We'd all seen them. Jim's seen them. You go to some place like Pine Valley, or you go to the National Golf Links. There couldn't be two more different golf courses. And yet, it's hard to choose. Which would I really prefer, you know, more? And it's just that experience of seeing things and trying to appreciate things and giving some thought to why do I like these more? But we've been so fortunate in the years to work with some just extraordinary places, not just new sites, but existing courses. And you just go out there and you just marvel at it. I've spent more than a few days walking around Cypress Point, you know, and be the only person out there in the afternoon. The only person. Everybody plays at Cypress Point in the morning. So in the afternoon, it's just fantastic. And you walk around and you go, in our best day, could we have ever thought of this? Could we have ever done this? And you go, well, I don't know about that. But it's just those kind of experiences and those kind of courses. And I wish I could just say, oh, it was 1 through 5. It was this, this, and this. As soon as I would do that, if I picked one of them and said, oh, that's number one, this 2, 3, 4, these are the 5 courses, I would go to one of the other 8 or 10 or whatever courses and go, ooh, I messed up. That one should be that. So it's just been a process.
The question is, after a course opens, what's the process for editing and any changes that are made over the years?
Well, it's a very good one, because that is a process that happens. If you're fortunate enough to work for a club or an ownership group or a family who, again, allows you freedom to work with a good site, you do the best you know how to do. I mean, right out of the box, you're doing everything that the way you think is the best way to do it as you're building the course. But it still happens in a fairly short period of time. And once that course is opened, you hope that the owners for whom you've worked will absolutely observe how that course handles play, be it just everyday play or be it championship play, but how it fulfills or perhaps doesn't fulfill the goals that were intended. And over a period of time, you go back and you say, all right, how do we see this? How has this progressed? And everything evolves, and you say, perhaps if we made a refinement here or a refinement there, it would be better. And the best owners, again, allow you to do that. And yes, Bandon Trails was one of them. I mean, Jim did so much of the work at Bandon Trails. And yet, once you see exactly how tight and firm that fescue got, for those of you who played out there years ago, like at number 18, and you would see it roll off the front of the green, and next thing, oh my God, it's 40 yards back down the fairway with the wind blowing from the north. And you know, that wasn't really what we intended. So when you're allowed the opportunity to go back and work, not really so much on the green, but right in front of it to try to address those issues. And we appreciate that. And even if you see that, whether it's one of our courses or anyone else's, if you see that in process, that doesn't mean it was bad the first time. It just means you've learned through the process, and people observe that, not that it was bad, but there could be a better way to handle some of the issues you've seen. So the best golf courses evolve through time.
I know you're not going to like this question. If you could put one of the holes in the sandbox in your backyard, which one would it be and why?
You want to answer that first? Yeah. I'll go for that, and then you can answer that. It'd be the third hole, the double plateau thing. We've talked about doing something like that for years, and we just never found the right situation to do it. And when we were walking out there, and Jim actually is the one who mentioned something about, we could do one of those somewhere, and you go, you're right, we could do it. And what would be perceived as either unfair, goofy, or just totally out of bounds on a regulation course, we thought could work here, and we watched enough play there today. And Tim, who made you made on 13, I guess.
I'll take 13.
But Mark, son, and so it's those kind of things. That wouldn't be the only one. There would be other ones, but that one for me personally just stands out.
Would your wife like it?
I'm sorry?
Would your wife like it back there?
Sure, the dogs could run over it, and she'd be okay with that.
That's good.
Well, we haven't talked about my cottage, but I think we could have all of them in my backyard. They just build it, my house right back there, and it could be my backyard. Michael, are you here, Michael?
Jim's cottage.
I can't say that I have a favorite. I mean, the third hole out here is a lot of fun, and we have looked for a spot like that. There's no doubt. You know, the National Golf Links has that green. It's different, but it's this kind of the same idea. There's so many of them. I don't know that I have a favorite. I would just ask you to pick one, and I'd say thank you very much. Yeah.
It's probably like picking your favorite kid.
Yeah, right.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being a part of this, and awesome course, and congratulations on another home run.
Thank you, Andy, and thank all of you for coming. We really do appreciate it. We hope you enjoyed the experience, and David Kidd's course is going to open here soon, and Sand Valley, who would have thought? The Kaisers have done it again.
You've been listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. We do the digging for you.